Hey, it's Joe. Today we're going to talk about body composition. I know, everybody's thinking that that's vanity, but really we're talking about having enough muscle mass and strength in your body to live the life that you want while not having excess body fat, in particular visceral fat, which is at the heart of so many chronic illnesses. So we're not talking about vanity here. We're talking about exactly what we talk about on this show, athletic longevity. And while it's actually not that hard to gain muscle or even to lose fat, doing both at the same time and sustaining them for the long term has proved very elusive. But today I think might be that day where I make a breakthrough, because today I am talking to Dr. Mike Ormsby. Mike is a scientist athlete who is researching health and body composition and human performance as the director of the Florida State University's Institute of Sports Sciences and Medicine. Mike agreed to join me to help us wise athletes understand how exercise, nutrition, and supplementation can be used to optimize metabolism, body comp, and performance. Well, I think that's what we all want to know. So let's talk to Dr. Mike Ormsby. Mike Ormsby, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, from my old alma mater. That's amazing. I've never interviewed somebody from Florida State University. So welcome.
Go Noles.
I also wanted to say that you are the exact right person, a scientist athlete, to help us wise athletes with the challenge of improving our fitness. And I mean both, you know, muscle strength as well as, you know, muscle energy production through mitochondria, while also losing this excess body fat that, dang it, everybody is carrying around, including me, and mostly this visceral fat, which does so much damage to our metabolic health. But ultimately, all of this just facilitates our goal here, mine and our audience, which is to hold on to our youthful health and resilience and athletic ability. So let me see here. You are the director of FSU's Institute of Sports Sciences and Medicine. You are researching health, body composition, and human performance to understand how exercise, nutrition, and supplementation can be used to optimize metabolism, body composition, and performance. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. Okay, so you are it, man. You are the guy. And you know what? Body comp is my number one thing right now. I've been working on it for 10 months, maybe. I had a DEXA scan that long ago, and I didn't do bad, but I wanted better, and I haven't done it. And not through a lack of effort. I've tried as hard as I possibly can, and I have failed. So and I noticed that you produced a course called Changing Body Composition Through Diet and Exercise. So you are exactly the right guy to talk to. All right. So thank you again for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. I'd love to jump into some of those topics as you wish.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we ought to, just for the audience's sake, just say, hey, look, okay, nothing is easy with human beings and behavior change. But some things are at least simple to understand, even if it's hard to do. And if all we wanted to do was build some muscle, that's not hard to understand how to do. We could do that. In addition, if all we wanted to do was lose some body fat, that's not very hard to understand how to do either. But when we want to do both at the same time, that turns out to be really hard and I think really complicated. What do you think? You're the expert.
Yeah, you know, the whole concept of adding and subtracting at the same time can get a little problematic. And some people think it defies the laws of thermodynamics to do both at the same time, where you're gaining in one spot and losing in another spot. And honestly, traditionally, that's how people have set it up. They would have a gaining cycle to gain as much mass as they could from muscle. And then they would do the opposite in, like, in a bodybuilding context, sort of lean out and go get ready for the stage. But It is possible to do both at once. And we can walk through several of examples of that. And even in a caloric deficit, there are data that indicate that you can both add muscle and lose fat at the same time. But you hit it right on the head, John. Like, it's not easy. And the amount of attention you'd have to put into that area of your life for that time could offset the joy you might get from the outcome. And that's something you need to sort of think through. Is the juice worth the squeeze when it comes to how badly do you need it or want it, and is it a wish or a desire or a necessity for like a health concern, for example. So there are different ways to cut it. And
sure.
It's, for example, in our hands, and I can walk through an example of people who are already have excess body fat, like a lot of it, and people who are already fairly lean. Let's start with the first group. And so we have done work in those who are very obese. All right. And so I understand that's not your current audience, but I want to just highlight the example. When we put one of the, some of these individuals, we put them into two groups. They were going in for bariatric surgery, Joe. So they were ready to have bariatric surgery. And we had them come do a study with us instead. And when we had them, our one group got resistance training and a higher protein intake. And the other group had a slightly higher protein intake, but no resistance training. It was simply like standard of care, which was calisthenics, walking around a room, and, you know, nothing that would require a gym, for example. And when we did that, the group, they all lost a ton of weight. So it was a 12-week study, medically supervised diet, which was something like 1,000 calories a day, super low, mostly liquid, like pretty terrible setup. But in that setup, you lose a lot of weight because you're going from in excess of 4,000 or 5,000 calories a day, at least, to 1,000. So you're going to lose a lot of weight. The group who did resistance training was able to maintain almost all of their muscle mass despite a drastic cut in calories. So they only lost 4% of their muscle mass.
Wow.
The group who did not do resistance training, instead, they lost 24, let's call it 25, a quarter of their muscle, of the weight they lost came from their muscle. And so, well, that sort of sets like the picture where it's like, you've got to be thinking about the nutrition and the type of exercise you're doing in conjunction. Because even if you're fairly fit, or you're just, you, like you said, some of your audiences, everyone's pretty reasonable. They all are exercising or at least trying to be active and eating fairly well, et cetera, but maybe have some weight to sort of shift around. It's the combination that is the strategy that wins. It's a combination of the training strategy and the nutrition. And when we separate those, you can have a result, but it's not in our hands. I've never seen this powerful as when you link those things together. And from a muscle perspective, I know we talked about that offline before we started. It's incredible the amount of power that the muscle has in this longevity piece of what we're talking about and how we really can optimize our life and our health span, not just our lifespan. And for us, like in all of our data with athletes too, when we start adding in the purposeful exercise in a way that's constructed to change body composition, I'm talking about resistance training specifically here, that is where we can either keep it in a major calorie deficit or add, even if you're in a lower, like a smaller calorie deficit, you can still add muscle in that scenario.
Well, that's great. I know that you, this course that you had put together, I don't know how many hours of instruction is on there. That's exactly on this topic, but, you know, 30 hours of learning or something. And we've got, you know, probably 40 minutes here left to get through. So we're not going to be able to cover every single thing, but in the show notes, I'll put a link to that course. So people who want to know more, they can go there to get that. For today, let's hit on what some of the big things, and I think we could start at the tippy top of the pyramid and we could talk about, you know, like principles and metrics, things you could track over time that are telling you whether you're getting there. I think one of the principles, I have what I think the principles are, and what I want to know is what you think the principles are, but one of them has got to have something to do with having patience on this. If you want to go fast and lose a lot of weight, you can do that. Usually, I think that the findings that when people lose weight really fast, they don't keep it off. But if you lose weight and you have lost a lot of muscle at the same time, and then you put the weight back on, well, I bet you didn't put that muscle back on. So you keep doing that yo-yo dieting thing. All you have done is stripped all the muscle off of your body. You know, now what are you going to do? So patience, I think, has got to be one of the things here. But the metrics that we could use that you must use, I want to know what they are, help you to see progress. You might not look the way you want to look after a month or, you know, 12 weeks, but you can see progress, and that can help a person to stay motivated, stay in the game here. So what would you say are like the major principles of success in this area, and how should a person sort of track how they're doing?
Yeah. Well, let's touch on your point of patience, for example, as a starting place. And, you know, there's some really good evidence that when you get into these cycles of prolonged caloric restriction, so you're simply not eating as much as you want to, perhaps, but you're planning this out over weeks and weeks and weeks, the psychological toll that takes can be tremendous, where after a while, that's incredibly hard to stick to. And so I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named Dr. Bill Campbell's work, but he has a lot of work on something called diet breaks. So in this strategy, it helps with the patience piece, is that he has really good data showing that going on, for example, there's different strategies to do it, but let's say call it a week. You do a week of the caloric restriction and you do a small diet break for a few days, and you go back on a week of caloric restriction. And there's, you know, even easier ways to split that up. But that strategy over the long term ends up with the same amount of weight loss, and you also don't feel like jumping off a cliff.
Well, the other thing that it would do, it seems to me, is that these days when you go off of your caloric restriction, you are practicing your maintenance diet, which if you're just dieting all the time, then when the diet is over, you don't really know how much to eat. Well, you haven't had any experience in that.
That's a key point, because one of the things that people do is they try to use that break and they have anything they could ever want. And that's not the point or the goal or the strategy. It is to go back to your maintenance dose. And so then you're not up splurging on everything that ever existed. It's you're in a restriction, then you're back to normal, you know, not going over and above. And so there are ways to measure that. And you can measure, you know, metabolic rate in any lab. You can even just calculate it. You know, we can probably throw some calculators in the show notes, or maybe you have those from other episodes. But when you do that, you can get pretty close to the number of calories that you should be eating. And you usually multiply like your resting metabolic rate by an activity factor. So usually that's 1.1 to like 1.7, depending on how active you are in a day. And so, yeah, I would say with the patience piece, the other thing is, for many people, it took a long time to get to the condition you are at presently. And so you have to give yourself a little grace in going the other direction as well. And so I feel like that's usually a hang up. And then trying to do everything at once. So one of the examples we use are, you know, if someone comes in and they're brand new, or even if they're used to exercising, but maybe not at a level that is competitive, let's say, like for a wise athlete, right? A more mature athlete. In that case, it doesn't make any sense for me to say, hey, come on in. Now, you do the same routine that I do every day, and I've been doing it for 20 years. It doesn't make any sense. Or to say, hey, eat exactly like I do, and you'll be fine. Like, that's too much. It's too fast. And you've now tried to change everything instead of taking a small habit-based approach. And so for our group, and the way that we recommend things and coach, is that you're going to have to do this in a stepwise progression. And Joe, like, we follow this scale where I say, Joe, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that you can do strategy X? And you tell me, well, that's a 4. I could maybe do it. And I'm like, well, that's not nearly enough. And you tell me, okay, well, let's give some real examples here. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that you can, let's just call it the basics, exercise 6 days a week? And you're like, maybe not you, because I know you exercise a lot, but someone would say, you know, a 5, I could do that maybe. And then you say, okay, well, how about on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it you could exercise 3 days a week? And you're like, oh, that's better. Like, I could probably do an 8 maybe. And then I say, that's still not enough. I like a 9 or a 10. So how likely is it you could do 2 days a week of exercise? And you're like, that's a 10. I can do 2 down. We're starting there with a strategy that's so easy, you barely even notice it. And if you came to me and you were paying for services, you'd say, what did I just pay for? And I said, you know what you're paying for? You're paying for something that will work after 3 weeks, because you're building these habits into your lifestyle. And we literally do that step by step, where it's so easy. You're like, why did I do that? And then they build, and all of a sudden after, you know, 6 months, you're in a place that you can be really proud of.
Great. Okay. Well, so what other kind of principles would you say, you know, high level kinds of things that you would advise people?
Yeah. So I think on the exercise front, let's start there. So my big three things are always, like, you probably wouldn't understand if we're getting into these, it's going to be exercise, nutrition, and sleep as the three big ticket items. And then we do a lot of nuance from there. But until those three things are as well controlled as we can, and I understand some of that is out of our control, but the exercise and nutrition piece, we try to get dialed in. And then the sleep changes as we age, of course. And so there are some things we can go down that rabbit hole, but those three things have got to be fairly well locked in. The exercise piece, though, a lot of times I hear everyone saying, oh, I need to do so much, exercise so much. And honestly, I think it's too much. I think you can really pull back on the volume of exercise and go after quality of movement and then just reframe what we think about as terms of like movement. So planned activity where you're purposefully in the gym or on the bike or doing a session that is for an outcome, a specific outcome, like a race, for example, or you want to be able to lift your body weight, for example, in a squat and a bench press or something. Those are great goals to have. They're functional. They get away from the scale, away from the body fats, and they get you kind of distracted in a way that makes you not so worried about these numbers that may not be changing as quick as you want, adds to the patience piece, and you get at something to change faster. So the exercise piece has to be goal-driven, and we dial that in terms of like what you can be doing. And then the volume, we typically bring it back. Unless someone really wants high volume, we bring it way back. So we're doing like 30 to 40-minute sessions, and that's usually where we're asking people to really get focused. And the rest of the activity is going to be more like take a walk with your spouse, move a little bit more, try to do these things that add value in terms of just general movement, but you wouldn't really consider planned, structured activity. And so if we move to the next bucket of big items, from the nutrition piece, at least from my perspective, the first thing I focus on is total energy intake, like how much food are we supposed to be eating. But every single time I eat, the first thing I'm looking at is what's my protein source and where is that coming from? The protein recommendations that this day and age are somewhere between 1.2 and 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight.
Whose recommendation?
So that's from the International Society of Sports Nutrition. That's also from the American Society of Nutrition. The IOC has a similar statement as well. So those who are into activity and sport. Now, the RDA, the recommended dietary allowance, is still 0.8 grams per kilogram. And that does cover people who are probably not active. And it would cover people in terms of not having a problem. And it's also two standard deviations above what was figured out from the original studies on that, which is like down near 0.6 grams per kg.
So you could survive even lower than that. You wouldn't die.
Yeah. So like 98% of the people theoretically are covered by this, but the gaps in that original data from these nitrogen balance studies were that they weren't studying active people. They weren't studying people trying to add muscle. They weren't studying these other areas. And protein isn't only for those purposes. We also have enzymes and cell structures, and it's one of the macronutrients that is quite satiating, which can help you from avoiding eating in excess in other areas. And so for me, I dial that number in first. If I'm looking at my plate, where's my protein source? And then I'll move from that protein source to where's my vegetable source. And the fats I sort of build into it, because I'm an omnivore, I'll have it embedded into meat sources. But there are, if you're not, you can do this as well. Just make sure you're having some nice fats that you're cooking with, for example. And then the starches I just modify based on my activity level. So, and I recommend that to any of the athletes that we've worked with as well. Is if you have the calorie range is very small, but I would add a little bit more on a training day and pull back a little bit on a non-training day. It's not massive swing for folks. And so nutritionally, that's where we land in terms of hierarchy would be energy, total calories in a day, protein, and again, total protein in the day. And then we fill in the other nutrients based on our goals. And then the nuance after you get through the big three buckets of exercise, nutrition, and sleep for the nutrition category would be, when do I eat these things? What time of day does it make a difference for me, et cetera? So that's a real advanced approach that we don't do until exercise, general nutrition, and sleep are pretty well handled. Our lab has a great reputation now for looking at things to eat before bed and how that affects sleep recovery, performance, and these other areas. And we do a lot of work in that space now with from younger to older athletes. We look at fat metabolism. We look at if you eat before bed, are you going to gain fat? Can you lose fat? Does it make any difference? And a lot of the discussions we have at this moment are around, does eating before bed change your sleep. And I'll tell you, the current data on eating before bed, if it's a small protein-centric meal or snack, so I'm talking about 150 to 250 calories, so a pretty small snack that's mostly protein, there's no data yet that's shown that that's problematic to sleep at all. However, you're an N of one, Joe, and if you know eating before bed makes you not sleep so well, then don't do it. Okay, that's like, we have to remember that how you feel when you do certain things is all that really matters, despite all the evidence. I will say the data support what we should do, evidence leading the suggestions, but at the end of the day, you have to think or try it and say, does it work for me or not?
And I have heard more recently that the effect of protein is very long lasting. And so, you know, if you're not having any more protein after you had your dinner, like say at 7 o'clock, I don't think you're short. As long as you ate enough protein at your dinner, you're not short of protein while you're sleeping. If you didn't have much protein, then maybe you would not have enough essential amino acids for protein synthesis. But my guess is that if you, so tell me if I'm right, if you're getting, you know, if you're going for a gram a pound, right, which is more than the 1.2 to 1.6 that you had mentioned, I'm talking about 2.2, which is always sort of been what I've been after. I actually have been trying to wind it back down to, instead of 200 grams, at about 150 grams, but I just like it too much.
Yes. Now, 2's a great place to aim for, because I find most people, like, at least in our country, they like to hear a gram per pound. And then what is useful is they typically don't hit that number and land right at 1.6 anyway. So it's a very easy number to remember. So like a take home message, okay, if I'm like, you know, 190 pounds of lean mass or 180 pounds, let's look to eat that amount of protein. I'll probably miss a little bit and be just fine. But here's the thing on the protein before bed. The biggest key right now is that it simply adds another opportunity to feed to get your total daily protein intake to the number that you want. Joe, you sound like an outlier in terms of protein intake. So while there are many Americans who will meet the 0.8 grams per kg and maybe even slightly higher, not a lot are hitting what we all think is maybe a more optimal dose, closer to that 1.6. And so with that context and, you know, just knowing that the range of protein intake in terms of percentages is 10 to 35%, most Americans fit around the 15% mark or lower, 12 to 15, basically. There's room to go up. And so if you're at home and you just know you haven't had enough protein today, that's a great time to get one extra feeding, where we know that it can help with muscle protein synthesis while you're asleep. It can help with recovery in some examples. If you happen to work out in the evening after work or something, it might also be an extra chance to have some regeneration occurring for muscular tissues. But at the end of the day, it's not a magic time frame. It's just another opportunity to feed. And we know, because we've done the microdialysis experiments, you won't get fat from it. In fact, it's the same amount of fat liberation from the adipose tissue in your abdominal belly fat if you have a protein drink or a non-caloric placebo right before bed. There's absolutely no difference in how your fat cells are responding. And we've also tested growth hormone changes and insulin and glucose changes and stuff. And with that low dose of calories and a high dose of protein, we're not seeing any negative changes at all from that mix.
Awesome. That's awesome. I mean, I always find it, I think probably most people have this experience where if you wanted to skip a meal, breakfast is the easiest one to skip because you're already into a fat burning mode overnight. And so you could just stay in your fat burning mode and not eat. Whereas dinner is very hard to skip. And I've always wanted to skip dinner. That would be the meal that, if I was going to do intermittent fasting, it would be dinner that I would skip. But man, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I physiologically or psychologically, I've gotten closer over the years, but I just can't do it. But breakfast, I always felt like I should get some protein going, you know, first thing in the morning. I haven't had any for 12 hours. I might as well get some going. But then once I start eating, then I start being hungry again sooner. So it's a nasty little trap. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Yeah, I think the intermittent fasting thing, just as you brought it up, is an interesting way. It's a tool. It's one tool in which people can use to control their calories. When they compare it to just general caloric restriction, over time, there doesn't seem to be much of or any of a difference at the end of a longer period of time. But you have to think about what suits your schedule. Like if you've got listeners who wake up like me trying to rush out the door, get children ready to go, get ready for work. Oh my gosh, what do I have? So sometimes it's easier to just run out the door. And that would be a fine scenario where you sort of backload your calories, hit your totals for the day in that way. I'll say when I go to bed, I'm like basically thinking about what can I wake up and eat in the morning for breakfast, because I always want breakfast. That's just my thing. But it's there's no right way other than really there's no wrong way other than if you choose to try something that you can't sustain forever.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there's an important point there, you know, maybe getting back to these principles. People are always talking about calories you burn, sort of an afterglow of exercise, and calories you burn from just fidgeting, and all of this other stuff. And I'm sure that smart people like you with very careful calculators have calculated that that stuff is really true. But for me, you know, that's just missing the point of you control how much weight you gain or lose by how much you eat. And so the whole thing is about controlling yourself, you know, having food in your refrigerator that you shouldn't have, or eating things that are satiating so that you do not, you know, continue to be hungry and eat the, I had 10 potato chips in my budget for dinner. I ate the whole bag, of course, because who could put the bag away?
Yeah. You know, the way we approach all of that is you do want to build your environment that makes it the easiest to meet your goals. So you're right. And like, if you have the right things around you all the time, it sort of helps. It's just like the concept of, you know, you're the product of the five people you hang out with most. You know, if those people are all fit and active, you'll probably be fit and active. If they're all, you know, wealthy, you'll probably be wealthy. There's just sort of that concept that goes with food. But we also need to give ourselves a break. You know, there's so much pressure to do this and that right at all times. And what you're describing is a great way to build what you need. But there are other things playing a role here that I think are necessary to address, at least quickly here, is that, especially for women, like going through the perimenopause, menopause transition, there are a lot of changes happening. And we do work specifically with female athletes here and through perimenopause and menopause. We've got a menopause study on now where we're looking at resistance training versus endurance exercise. And, you know, these women suffer from many different changes that all lead to changes in body fat that they did not want, despite, you know, at least in discussions, not changing caloric changes all that much or caloric intake. And so there are things beyond just the calories that need to be looked at in the overall picture of these, of how somebody's life is shaping up in terms of body composition and health. For example, in perimenopause, like we're running a study right now in collaboration with Dr. Abby Smith Ryan, who's up at UNC Chapel Hill. And she's basically taking women and looking at protein pre-exercise or not, and looking at high intensity interval training. And it piggybacks off of other work she's done where she was able to show that if you had a little bit of protein, if women had a little bit of protein before exercise, they actually had a higher increase in caloric expenditure after exercise and all day long.
Wow.
Because they ate before exercise and they had just a little bit of protein before that. So there's something to this mix in both men and women that you build your environment the best you can, and then you use the science to sort of try these techniques that might help a little bit. And then you have to see what works for you and your family and your lifestyle.
Okay. So you're saying that there could be little tricks of the trade that if you employ them, they all add up. And if they get enough of them, they'll add up to something material. I mean, if you were really just by when you ate your meals, or, you know, how much protein you had, or, you know, these little things you've been talking about, you somehow manage to create a 100 calorie deficit every day without changing how much you ate. That would add up. You would lose weight with that.
Yeah, it certainly adds up over time. And you know, sometimes people sort of push aside small changes. But if you did those strategies all the time, you'd have a win.
Yeah.
And those wins come gradually. They come over time. And we also know that caloric, or at least weight loss, is not linear. Everyone wants it to be linear, but in reality, it's all over the place. And it bumps up and down. And so if you're weighing yourself every day, it's probably too much, where you're just seeing a fluctuation that could be water, it could be real, it could be fake. and you have changes that are expected. And 2 to 3 pound shift is probably normal, and it just should keep over time going the direction you want, but maybe not day to day.
Yeah, the scale is very hard. So many things are changing, and so many people have psychological barriers to that. But anyway, I can tell how I'm doing by how my pants fit. So I don't have to have a scale, even though I do use it every single day.
Well, Joe, just to follow up, because I don't think we finished that topic. Like, I would get away from that view and look more at the performance metrics, which is one of the things you asked about. Like, what are some things you think you should be able to do?
Go ahead and hit that again.
Yeah, I think that those metrics are important. First of all, if you're training for a goal, that's the best thing. So if you have a 5K coming or a half marathon, or you've got a strongman competition, or CrossFit or whatever it is, that is such a great way to instill a sense of wins, because you're training for a purpose and you can see the outcomes in terms of performance. We always push performance outcomes over body comp outcomes, at least for the first while, because those are far easier to see and to achieve.
And you get a little social pressure. You know, you've committed to doing something and you've told people, and now you really can't back out, and maybe you're doing it with a friend.
100%.
So that's 100%. All good.
So those are great, and I would start there. Now, if we're on sort of on the longevity spectrum, if you've got older athletes that are in here, like the wins you can get are tremendous, and you can still add muscle mass at any age. Like, all those things are important to know, so you can still have muscle mass goals. But other things like hand grip strength, we talked offline about the dead hang, right? So like, how long can you hold yourself arms extended? Yeah. And the dead hang is becoming a popular metric just to see, because it's not really just about your grip strength. It's about how long have you been lifting heavy things for your whole life. And at that point,
Well, it also gets your body weight is incorporated into that as well. But there's no like standard for goodness. It's just get better over time.
Yeah. So there's that, exactly. You want to achieve a certain goal, and there's certain practitioners and social media people that have pretty good metrics on what to look for. I tell you, they're hard to hit, though. For example, like a 2-minute dead hang is pretty hard to hit. And so working up to that is great to achieve. And there are other little things that I like to do that are just tasks that are pretty simple. So example, like I'm sitting down right now. Next time I leave my office door, that you make little rules. So I can't leave my office door until I do 5 air squats and 5 push-ups.
Oh, nice.
And then it just sort of, we call it grease the groove. It gets you in a routine of just doing something. They call them exercise snacks, to make little rules for yourself before you can leave a room. Maybe you have a pull-up bar in the door and you do 2 pull-ups every time you leave or enter that particular space. So there are little things like that, I think, that can also help with these performance metrics.
Okay. Do you do anything like, a DEXA scan is a good idea for people if they can find one in their area. They're not terribly expensive, and you don't want to do it every month anyway. So, but that'll really help. It'll give you your bone density. That's important to know. It'll also tell you your visceral fat, which really there's no way to know whether your liver and your pancreas and whatever are suffering from this. And there's the whole skinny fat thing. People with a very low fat threshold, they have barely any fat, but it's all in their organs and they're sick. They can be diabetic, even though they don't look like they're overweight. They look like they're underweight.
Yeah. We've actually run several normal weight obesity is the scientific term for skinny fat. And we've done several of those studies. And honestly, one of them was in our collegiate dancers. And in collegiate dancers who all appear and have low BMIs, they all appear visually thin and have low BMIs, we had 40% of them were technically obese.
Oh my God.
Yeah, 40%.
That's shocking.
It was shocking. And the diets are a big problem with that. And the culture around diets for aesthetic athletes is really poor. So that is shocking. And so we do DEXAs. We typically do VO2 maxes for our longevity profile. So we have a testing services out of our Institute of Sports Sciences and Medicine. So we'll do DEXA, VO2 max. A lot of times we'll ask them to do a full blood panel as well. And chances are, if you're a master's level athlete, you've had blood work done. But if by chance you haven't, do it and do it right away and get everything tested, because you need a baseline from the time you felt your best. And if you have children, tell them to get it done, because you should have a baseline from when you feel your best, because when you get tested the next time, it's when you feel bad or something's off. And then they don't know how to dose you or get you back to what you were. And even if, so the problem is our normative ranges and blood biomarkers. And so the normative values are basically anybody who's come in and gotten tested, who most people who are doing that don't feel good.
And we have a 40% obesity rate. So they're in those ranges.
Right. And so your norms matter even more. And so a true baseline, and that's really important to get on body fat, on general strength, on aerobic capacity, and these blood biomarkers.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to run out of time here, and we've not hit on a ton of specifics yet. So let me hit you with some questions as we start to wrap up here. So for exercise, that could mean anything. In general, I think that it means resistance training. That was how you hang on to your muscle when you're losing your fat. So we know that that's got to have that. And probably people should be doing some endurance kind of work, cardio type of work. One of the benefits of cardio, I mean, first of all, it's good for your health, but that's how you can tell your body you need more mitochondria. And through other guests I've had on the show, if you're putting mitochondria, signaling to your body to have mitochondria in your muscles, that is telling it to build mitochondria everywhere in your body. You'll have healthier skin. You'll have healthier everything if you get your muscles better able to make energy using oxygen. But then what about things like high intensity, where I'm, you know, sprinting, or I'm on a bike or on the ground, or I'm doing something that gets my heart rate up as high as I can make it go? Is that an important part of this?
Yeah, I do think that a multimodal exercise is probably the best approach. And we've got data to support that. There's a series of studies that I was involved with for some of them that were run by a guy named Dr. Paul Arciero. And they were nicknamed the PRISE studies, P-R-I-S-E, the PRISE studies. And that's an acronym for P was protein, R was resistance, I was interval or sprint training, S was stretching or yoga, and E was endurance. And so the way that we ran those studies all those years was that you had one of those a day. You had your resistance training, your high intensity interval training, you had your stretching or yoga, and you had your endurance session. Take a day off, rinse and repeat, and on you go. And you had higher protein for all of that. And then several, I mean, there's probably six of those studies. I was involved with three of them. There are benefits to having this multimodal exercise in middle-aged and active and sedentary individuals. And so I think having a lifestyle, an exercise lifestyle where you can basically pick up and take part in anything that's going on at any time is a great way to approach it. And we're going to stop sprinting at some point, and then your ability for fast twitch muscles to activate goes down, and all of a sudden you have this cascade of events where you can't play with your kids or your grandkids. And so I think you have to have enough strength to be able to do the daily tasks that keep you motivated to be here and to be doing good work. And if that's, like for me, if that's, you know, being able to chuck my kids in a pool and race them around and, you know, up and down off the floor all the time. And so even things like burpees, right, Joe? People are like, oh, they're a useless exercise. Well, really? My kids do it all the time and I need to do it with them.
Oh my God. Last weekend I did 100 burpees. And let me tell you, 10 burpees is nothing. 100 kicked my ass.
Yeah, man, that'll do it.
That is hard.
It'll do it.
Oh my God. Okay. Related to the high intensity, yeah. I had heard that high intensity exercise did what I thought was impossible. It targeted your visceral fat. It somehow used your visceral fat preferentially over other sources of fat. And the answer was sort of vague. It was sort of like, well, maybe it's a proximity thing. But have you ever heard anything like that?
Yeah, you see that thrown around from time to time in terms of how it would target it. But there's no data that I can lean on confidently that would tell me that would preferentially go after a certain type of fat, because there are studies showing that the subcutaneous abdominal adipose tissue, like right in your belly, does contribute quite a lot to exercise energy expenditure.
Okay.
And so I think it's just the overall caloric burn situation, Joe, where that type of exercise is extremely difficult. And so you got to be mentally ready to take on actual high intensity work. And I would include it. I would include it as part of the deal, but it's not going to preferentially do visceral.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, in our studies where we include weight training and high intensity interval training, it's over a period of time, we had greater losses in visceral fat specifically when compared to a group who just did walking or running 5 days a week.
Okay. So whether it was targeting that or just was burning more fat, and so some of it came there. And you might even, I mean, it's sort of logical that the the reason that the fat goes there is because it's run out of places to go. You know, and if you've not got a lot of fat storage because maybe you grew up skinnier genetically, you just don't have a lot of fat stores, then that's why you could be skinny fat, because you don't have places to put fat. So your body's saying, well, I don't want to throw those calories away. I'm gonna put them here.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if that's the last place they go, then that would be the first place they would come from if the body was losing fat. I mean, is there any truth to that?
Not really. I mean,
bummer.
There's truth in that you have probably some type of a cap on where you can store all these calories. And if you are having a surplus all the time, you got to store it somewhere. It's got to go somewhere. That's why muscle is so incredibly important. It's a good place to store a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You can jam a lot of carbohydrates into muscle. You can jam fat into muscle as a way to keep your blood clean, you know, for lack of a better word. And you can grow more adipose cells. So there's that. The visceral connection is incredibly complicated in that we know it's a problem. It's very hard to understand exactly what will access it. And it's different for each person, so that your exercise, maybe you're pulling from there. And honestly, there's a layer of this that's super complicated, but the receptor type on the actual fat cells makes a difference, so that if you have a certain receptor type, you're more likely to lose fat from that fat depot. For example, men and women have different shapes of their adiposity typically until menopause. Sure. And then at menopause, it changes. And that also changes the alpha beta receptor type on fat cells, which means now women's shape becomes more like a man's shape after menopause. Because of that, you can just store fat a little bit more readily in the adipose area.
Got it. Okay. And so one last thing. So related to the diet, you had said, you want to get your protein, and it's not a percentage, but rather the, you know, and a number of grams based on your body weight. Although, you know, maybe if you've got a lot of excess body fatness, then you maybe don't want to get extra protein for that, but maybe like your target weight, you know, for the amount of protein. I am always minimizing my fat. I mean, of course there's fat in the protein source, some of them anyway. You know, if I eat salmon, there's fat in there. And mostly I just eat fish and a little bit of chicken. So I'm getting some fat there, but I don't eat fat. I don't go out of my way to eat fat. I don't put fat on my food. And it's just because of the calorie budget. You know, I'm just trying to keep I'm trying to get all of the nutrients that I need without going over my budget. And so I need a certain amount of protein. And for me, I believe I need a good amount of protein. I need a little bit of fat. You know, I want my omega-3s, EPA, DHA. So, I focus on fish. And I need fiber. I need to keep my gut healthy. A healthy gut, I think, makes me a healthier person. And the fiber comes from my carbohydrates. And so once I have satisfied all of that, now I've just got, I should have some diversity in the, you know, the phytonutrients that I get. And one of the goals that I picked up, tell me what you think of this, is from the American Gut Project. They said that the people with the healthiest guts ate 40 different plants every single week. And so that's a goal that I have. I have not actually quite hit that ever, because that's a lot of different things. But I shoot for 40 plants a week, and that includes spices and herbs, and, you know, it's anything that's from a plant can count. But what it drives is a lot of diversity. And diversity, I think, matters for two important reasons. One is that you have better chance of covering all your bases. The other thing that it accomplishes is that it minimizes the chance that you're picking up an overload of some toxin, you know, whether it's what people call anti-nutrients that's in, you know, plants, or it's just something that was in the food supply, you know, that, you know, some BPA or whatever. Yeah. That, you know, you shouldn't get. If you're just eating the same things over and over again, you're much more susceptible to having a problem. Does that make any sense to you? What do you think?
Yeah, for sure. That gut diversity is a massive topic now, and the gut microbiome has been huge on research agendas for the last 10 years or so. And there is something to that diversity. I will say that the complicated part about research in that space around athletes is that you can measure and see different types of bacteria going in different directions with a change in the diet or an addition of a supplement or something, for example. But it's very hard to say what that means. Is that good, bad, or is it just moving? But I think you can confidently say that diverse amount of foods and a diverse gut bacteria is probably and logically your best chance for a healthy gut. And so I like that approach for sure. And, you know, we are very much underfibered because so many of the foods are just stripped that people are eating and these ultra processed foods and such. So yeah. I think with your goal of hitting 40, I mean, that's a ton, but I think even if you could diversify to like some different types, so many families won't eat anything, but if they have any, maybe green beans, and then you try broccoli, try spinach, then try all these other things. And so I think you can just, once again, I think we overcomplicate. So I don't have time to go do every single thing, including, you know, eat 100% right, exercise exactly right, take care of everybody, look at the sun, get in a cold bath, and do all the appropriate steps every single day. But what I can do is pick something that feels manageable and easy. Like I can add, let's say every day I say, can on a scale of 1 to 10, Joe, can you have a vegetable with 3 of the times you eat today? And you're like, 100%, I'm in, right, let's go. And so for me, that's a step forward. And if you already have it dialed in, sure, go for this 40. I don't see any harm to it. And I think it will help with that diversity, which is a good thing.
Okay, you've been patient with your time. Last question, supplements. Since that's listed as one of the things you study, I got to know what you think. What supplements should wise athletes take that are going to either help them with their, you know, muscle building or weight loss, or just help them with their health?
Yeah. So the first one on my list these days is vitamin D. Even though I live in Florida, even with sun exposure, we know that it's not as easy as we once thought to just having more sun exposure, getting the right amount of vitamin D circulating in your blood. So a vitamin D supplement is something that I recommend. And there can be many different manufacturers of that, but vitamin D is a great source. We typically are going 400 IU or more for various reasons, but that's okay, where we start. The other ones that I tend to look at nowadays, I do creatine, and I like creatine for older athletes. Outside of the physical benefit, the cognitive potential is enough to warrant use.
And how much?
So I've switched that. I used to just do 5 grams a day and never came off of it. And it looks like it's a little harder to get that into your blood-brain barrier, through your blood-brain barrier. So I'm now doing 10, and I'll follow the science because it looks like it's a little higher for the cognitive benefits to that. In fact, just yesterday, a study came out with Alzheimer's patients taking creatine and were showing benefits in several outcomes. And so I think as we age, that's one that very much has the potential to be on a decline in brain and cognition. And certainly for a performance perspective, there's evidence on that side. So those are two big ones. I also, because of a study we ran, like collagen, and collagen peptides are something I was super skeptical of for a very long time. So we decided to run a study on it, and we did 9 months of consumption in lifelong athletes that were 45 to 60 years old. And in our hands, 10 grams of collagen peptides a day. And the people who are most active, so those who exercised more than 188 minutes per week, ended up having less joint pain and better mood states because of it. Because if everything's hurting, you're in a bad mood. And so it was connected. And so they had their pain was subsiding and their mood was getting better. And it was a very applied study, but we did 9 months of it, Joe, and it was the longest study I've ever seen with collagen peptides, and it changed my mind. So I take that daily as well.
And did it take a long time for the benefits to show up? Because let me tell you, I've taken it for a month at a time many times and felt nothing from it. And I'm wondering, did I just not take it long enough for it to materialize?
Yeah, so 6 months is about where we started seeing some good things. We did the 9 months and it basically plateaued after that 6 months. We were trying to see if there might be a bone change after 9 months, and we were right on the cusp of if something would change, it might not. So we didn't probably go long enough to see the bone if it was going to happen. So it'll be a long-term thing. And I put 10 grams a day. You should probably take it with vitamin C. And you should also take it before exercise, because that is the time when if you're going to get any blood flow to a tendon, a joint, or like a knee, you probably need to do it before exercise. Right. So those are the ones that for myself and for others in a similar situation, athletes, you know, I still compete and used to play competitive college sports and everything along the way. And I those are the ones I definitely go to now. There are others, but those are the big ones, unless you include protein as a supplement, and then that would be included in there.
Okay. Is the protein from like a powder just as good as protein from some food, like a fish or?
Yeah. So here's the thing. When you eat whole foods and you do that to get your protein source, you're getting all the other nutrients. So that is the best way to go. Yeah. If you're like me and you just need convenience in your life, a protein shake is excellent. You get, I would do like a whole whey protein, for example, or whey protein isolate. That's for the muscle building and other aspects. Collagen is separate. Don't use collagen to build your muscle. There's no evidence that that works. Huh. They're different amino acid profiles.
Yeah.
So the studies haven't been done to go the other way yet, where to see if the whey proteins help with the joint pain. But there seems to be something nice about a collagen, at least in the data that exists now, where you get these proline, hydroxyproline matrices that come across the gut intact.
Yeah.
And then they're having some benefit in these spaces of joint pain. So,
and those amino acids are not in the whey protein that I've ever seen.
Well, so they have the amino acids, but the way that their helical structure forms is different in the collagen. The way that that's coming across from, and the ones that we use was a bovine skin product. So it is an animal based product. So you'd have to take it from, if you were vegan, you would want to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is great. I, of course, have, you know, 3 more hours of questions for you, but I got to let you run here. Before we cut off, do you want to tell the audience how they can find you, your work? And you can mention this great courses thing. I sure. already have the link for that, but go ahead and mention it.
Yeah. The great courses is a great place to start if you're interested in like a user-friendly course. It's not, I mean, frankly, it's not the most entertaining thing in the world. But it's like taking a class with me.
Yeah.
And it was my first shot at being on TV and on the media, so give me a break. But it's great content. It's 24-30 minute lectures. So okay. That's the structure, and it's the basics. It's like all of nutrition and exercise roped into how it changes body composition, and we go through chapters on supplements and carbohydrates and fats and proteins and all of this. So it's a great place to start to get a really nice baseline of information. It's about 10 years old now almost. So just so you're aware, the science is the same. I wouldn't teach it any different. I might just add a few more things to it if I were to redo the course, but okay. I still would recommend it as a place to start. That's on Amazon, or you can get it on the Great Courses online, or just Google it. It'll come up.
Yeah.
The other place to get a hold of me is on the social media outlets, just at my name, at Mike Ormsby. You can get that on Instagram or whatever. And we usually post about our studies, our different projects that are coming up. We have our research website, which is FSUISSM. So at Mike Ormsby or at FSUISSM, and you can find out a whole lot about what we're up to here at the Institute of Sports Sciences and Medicine.
Fantastic. All right, Mike, this was great. Thank you, buddy. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Mike Ormsby. You can find more information about Dr. Ormsby in the show notes.